Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. On the program today, the news of this economy, of course, also the privacy perils of modern technology. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today, 19 September. Good as it always is to have you along, everybody. Let me just get this out of the way real quick, and then we can move on, okay? Federal Reserve meets tomorrow. Interest rates probably staying where they are. Okay, so now to the actual nuts and bolts of this economy. We are going to go with housing today, about which there's been some less than great news the past couple of days, specifically about the housing pipeline. The Commerce Department says the number of housing starts fell more than 11% last month. The National Association of Home Builders says home builder confidence is down this month for the second month in a row. A lot of that is, of course, thanks to high mortgage rates. We talked about that. But the NAHB, the National Association of Home Builders, as I said, says those home builders are facing some supply side challenges, too. And we're not talking 2x4s and plywood here. Marketplace's Justin Ho enlightens us about something called an electrical distribution transformer.
You've probably seen one of these transformers before. A green or tan box near the sidewalk, or those trash can-looking things attached to a utility pole.
Typically on a utility pole, they're round, and they're at the top of the pole.
That's John Kirk, managing director at Embry, a multifamily developer based in San Antonio. He says electrical transformers convert the electricity from the grid into electricity you can use in a house. In other words, construction companies need new transformers, or else an entire project can get delayed.
It's one of your top questions you ask. You want to go meet with the utility provider and say, hey, what's the story? What should we be expecting?
Kirk says the wait time for a transformer has grown from 3 to 4 months to at least a year. Rose Quint with the National Association of Home Builders says they've been in short supply since 2018, back when the Trump administration slapped tariffs on Chinese transformers.
As a result of that, the number of transformers that we bring in from China has fallen by nearly 90%.
Meanwhile, the U.S. has also placed tariffs on the kind of steel used to build transformers domestically. As a result,
we have seen the price of transformers increase by 85% since roughly the first quarter of 2018.
That's not only a problem for home construction. Aaron McLaughlin, senior economist with the Conference Board, says we also need new transformers to modernize the electric grid, something the Biden administration has been trying to promote.
All of the industrial policies, such as the Infrastructure Act to support electrical vehicle charging stations, and also our expansion of renewable energy into the grid.
McLaughlin says all of that will be a challenge if electrical transformers are still hard to find. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, another session of not too terribly much movement. Waiting for Jay Powell is where the smart money lies. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today is day 5 of the UAW strike, which I mentioned because among the union's demands is a shorter work week, 32 hours over 4 days at 5 days, 40 hours pay, to be clear. It's not a new idea, but it's mostly been centered around white-collar jobs. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab made some calls today, though, to see whether it could work in restaurants or in trucking or in manufacturing, too.
You know that meme, this meeting could have been an email? Well, that old office joke is part of the reason why chatter about the 4-day work week has mostly stayed in the white-collar world. Matthew Bidwell is a professor of management at Wharton.
I mean, essentially, people believe in an office we waste so much time that if we went down from 5 days to 4 days, we could do it without kind of seriously affecting the amount of output.
Meanwhile, for work outside the office,
there's a sense that blue collar work is kind of less stretchy.
Physical work is limited. You can only assemble so many cars in a day. And so there's a perception that blue collar work is not as flexible, as if there's less fat to trim. But Bidwell says, of course, blue collar work can have inefficiencies too.
We all waste time all the time.
A 4-day work week could force companies to be more efficient. But Ben Friedrich, a professor of strategy at Northwestern, worries it could instead lead to burnout, especially for people doing jobs that are physical and repetitive.
And so if it just means a faster assembly line and people getting really stressed and being put under a lot of pressure, I don't think they would like that.
Boston College economist Juliet Shore is writing a book about the 4-day work week, and she says companies that are implementing it right see boosts in productivity, revenue, and employee recruitment and retention.
Results are absolutely consistent across every type of industry. So the 4-day week is absolutely relevant for blue-collar workers as it is for office workers.
And she says historically, unions have led the fight for fewer hours. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Years ago, 1999, if you want to actually put a date on it, Scott McNeely, the then CEO of the then big deal tech company Sun Microsystems, said about consumers, "You have zero privacy, get over it." That's a quote. Not only did we not get over it, going on 25 years later now, consumer privacy is arguably the defining challenge of how we live with the new tools of technology, specifically for us right now, facial recognition. I mention that because there's a new book out from Kashmir Hill. She covers technology at the New York Times. Her book is called Your Face Belongs to Us. Kashmir Hill, welcome to the program. It is great to have you back.
Thanks for having me on, Kai.
I want to start not with the title of this book, but with the subtitle, which in my experience sometimes reveals more than the actual title does. So the book is called Your Face Belongs to Us, as I said, A Secretive Startup's Quest to End Privacy as We Know It. Would you explain for us, please, what this secretive startup is? And then I've got one more question about that.
Yes. So I heard about this company a few years ago. I got a kind of crazy tip and I first was skeptical. I didn't think it could be true. It was this company, Clearview AI, that claimed to have scraped billions of photos from the public internet without people's consent to build a database of something like a billion photos. And it was selling a facial recognition app to police that it said could identify somebody with something like 99% accuracy, take a photo of their face, and it pulls up any place on the internet where it's appeared.
So a couple of things now, actually, now that you've given me that answer. Number one, you said 2019, which is 4 years ago, which is forever ago. So this company's been around for a while now.
Yes. And their database now has 30 billion faces.
30 billion faces. Okay. All right. So the actual follow-up I was going to ask, this company is called Clearview AI. It's not Facebook. It's not Google. It's not the biggies that I would have thought. How is it that this small, never heard of almost until you started writing about it in the New York Times company has such oomph now?
Yeah. You know, one thing that I found that surprised me was that Facebook and Google had both actually developed this very technology internally. They both created apps that you could take a photo of somebody or even point a phone at them in the real world and find out their name. And both companies said, wow, this seems like it seems too dangerous to release. We don't want to be the ones to put that out there. And so what Clearview AI did wasn't so much a technological breakthrough as an ethical one.
Sorry, I know that's not a question. It's just more of a response, but wow. Well, so actually along those lines, tell us please what happened when Clearview found out you started asking around about them, because they reacted.
Right. So when I first heard about them, I started trying to find any information I could about them to find out if what they were selling was real. And there was very little available on the internet. I started trying to find people connected to the company, you know, including a lawyer who'd written a legal memo for them. His name was Paul Clement, and he had basically created this memo telling police officers that, don't worry, you can use this app. It's not illegal. And Peter Thiel, who appeared to be one of their earliest investors, and then trying to just find out the people who worked for the company. And it was so difficult. They did not want to talk to me, even though they had, you know, created this tool that was able to find so much information about people. They wanted to stay in the shadows.
And didn't they start doing something with, like, your picture and how it started turning up in search results and all that?
Yeah. So when I started investigating them, they actually had this address on their website for their building. And it was just a few blocks away from the New York Times office. So I walked over there and discovered that the address didn't exist. The building wasn't there. I mean, it was that hard to find information about them. So I realized, well, if the company doesn't want to talk to me, I'll try to find police officers who have used the app. And I reached out to quite a few police departments. I eventually was able to talk to a financial crimes detective in Gainesville, Florida. His name was Nick Ferrara. And he just loved the app so much. He said it worked like no facial recognition technology he'd used before, that he had kind of a stack of known criminal offenders, kind of financial fraudsters on his desk, and all the cases were at a dead end. They hadn't had any results in his kind of state facial recognition database, and that he got a free trial of Clearview and just started running these photos through the app and got hit after hit after hit. And I just remember he said, man, they're so great. I'd be their spokesperson if they'd let me. And I said, well, I'd love to see how this works. And he said, well, send me your photo and, you know, I'll run your photo and send you the results. I did that. And then he just stopped talking to me. I talked to another officer who, again, sung the company's praises, said he would show me the results. And so I sent him a photo and he said, oh, it's so strange. You actually don't have any results. I see you have a lot of photos on the internet. You should be in the app, but you're not here. And then he stopped talking to me. And so I eventually end up recruiting a police detective who worked in Texas. This detective agreed to help me investigate Clearview AI. So he went to their website. He requested access to the app, which you could basically get if you had a police email address. And he ran my photo through the app, confirmed there were no results. But then a couple of minutes later, he said he got a call from somebody who worked for Clearview AI, and they wanted to know why he'd been running my photo.
Okay, sorry, but that's terrifying, right? This company like disappeared you and then said, no, actually, we're going to reach out and see what's going on here. I mean, come on.
It was really chilling for me because it showed me two things. One, this company, you know, they're not talking to me, but they're tracking who I'm talking to, and they're able to see who law enforcement is looking for. But also, it showed me they control who can be found. They had decided I shouldn't have any results.
Not to leave you hanging, but we got a couple of things we got to get done. Part two from Kashmir Hill on the other side. Coming up,
gourmet food, people enjoy it in general.
Well, yes, we do. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 106 today, about 0.3%, closed at 34,517. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ slid 32 points, about 0.2% there, 13,678. The S&P 500 dipped 9 points, also 0.2%, 44.43. Justin Ho was talking about housing and construction and pipelines and all that. So the big builders, how did they do on Wall Street? Toll Brothers gained 0.1%. Lennar increased 0.2%. D.R. Horton rose 0.4%. Disney plummeted 0.3% today. And that is after the company said it plans to invest $60 billion over the next decade in cruise lines, theme parks, and other ventures. Speaking of cruises, Truist upgraded both Carnival and Royal Caribbean. The bank forecast next year and the year after is looking especially strong for the industry. Carnival picked up 0.3%, Royal Caribbean climbed 2.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. When last we heard from Kashmir Hill, whose new book is called Your Face Belongs to Us, she was recounting her journey into what facial recognition really means and her dawning realization that as she was trying to track down Clearview AI, the company was also tracking her. You eventually wound up sitting down with the co-founder of this company, whose name I'm gonna absolutely mispronounce here, but I'll give it a whack. It's Huan Thanh Phat. Does he come off as a supervillain?
So Huan Thanh Phat, it took a while to get his name. He'd been using an alias on LinkedIn. And when I first found out he was tied to the company, I Googled him and just these crazy photos came up. I mean, he had this one photo he'd uploaded to Spotify alongside some of his guitar playing. And he was shirtless, lighting a cigarette and just covered in what looked like blood. And so I didn't know what I was going to get when I met with him. But when I did finally, meet him at a WeWork that the company had rented for the occasion, he looked very much the kind of staid security entrepreneur. He's just wearing, a blue suit, had glasses. It was a very different version of him than I'd been expecting, given what I'd found about him online.
And what does he have to say about, as you said earlier, the ethical line that this company seems to have crossed, not a technological line?
So during that first interview, he seemed to not really have grappled with the ethical line that they had crossed. He really focused on the fact that they were only selling the technology to police departments. I remember this very specific line. He said, you know, this is the best use case for facial recognition technology. It's being used to find pedophiles, not to be used by them to find information on children. And, you know, that is what he told me when I first met him, when I first did that story about Clearview AI. But part of why I wrote this book is a lot of people called me after that story came out and they said, you know, this isn't what this company was first thinking. You know, they wanted to use it for all kinds of different things, like use it at political conferences, have businesses use it. Really, they just evolved into the police use case because those were the easiest customers to get.
Right, right. All right. So look, I want to get to the privacy thing here in a minute, right? Because that obviously is key to this whole thing. But people will be screaming at their radios and or whatever their streaming device is as this interview airs for me to ask you this question. What about the known biases and challenges with facial recognition, right? It does really poorly with Black Americans. It does really poorly on a bunch of different things. How is this possible that this company is allowed to just do this?
This has been one of the biggest and strongest criticisms of facial recognition technology. You know, tracking the history of it, I saw why. Basically, the people working on this were often white men, and they wanted to make sure that it worked on them and it worked on their friends who were also white men. And those were the photos they used to train the technology. But the vendors did take this criticism to heart, and they have gotten better about training the tech on more diverse faces. Mm. And it has improved over time. And so it's not that it's, you know, been eliminated of the handful of people we know to have been wrongfully arrested based on a bad facial recognition match who were arrested for the crime of looking like someone else. In every instance, the person has been Black.
Yeah. Okay, so the follow-up to that one is, where are the regulators? Where's the American government? I'm sure the Europeans are more on this than the Americans are, because that's the way that has turned out to be. But where are the regulators?
At the federal level in the United States, there really hasn't been much done about facial recognition technology yet. And that is in strong contrast to countries outside of the U.S. When Clearview AI's existence became public, privacy regulators in Europe, Canada, Australia, all announced that they were launching investigations into the company. And they have all found that what Clearview AI did was illegal. They said, you know, this violates our privacy laws. You can't put people's photos in your database without their consent.
All right. So look, you don't spend 4 years and however much mental energy you have writing about tech dystopia as you have done in this book. So the question is, what do you hope people get out of this?
I mean, I want readers to, one, know that these tools are out there, because I don't think that people realize that facial recognition technology has come along as much as it has. And while Clearview AI is limited to police, there are public face search engines. And for people to think about what rules we need to set for how this is used, how police are using it to prevent kind of false arrest.
So let me get you back to where we started, the subtitle of this book, A Secretive Startup's Quest to End Privacy as We Know It. Is that what's on the line here, privacy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that technology like this, if it really becomes ubiquitous, it just changes what it means to be in public. You know, if you go outside in not in your best outfit, or you're making a sensitive purchase at a pharmacy, you kind of do all those things assuming that the people around you won't be able to know who you are. But with a technology like this, somebody could just take a photo of your face and now they can connect you to that purchase, to that poor fashion choice. And I just think that that could be really chilling just at the day-to-day citizen level, not to mention what could be done with this by companies and governments.
Kashmir Hill is a technology reporter at the New York Times. Her new book is called Your Face Belongs to Us. The subtitle, I think we've gone over a couple of times in this interview. Kashmir, thanks a bunch. I appreciate it. Great book.
Thank you so much, Kai.
good decent amount of oil on this program because it's oil. Crude bumping up against $100 a barrel if you're keeping track. But a story now about oil of the dip, drizzle, and sauté variety. The Department of Agriculture says olive oil prices have hit a record high this month. Drought and extreme heat in the big growing regions of the Mediterranean this summer are the proximate cause, thus putting the squeeze on global supplies for the second year in a row. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino is on it.
Olive oil is a way of life in the Mediterranean, where most of the world's supply is still produced and consumed. It's been used in cooking, skincare, and traditional medicine for millennia. Casey Korn is a food anthropologist, and yes, her last name really is Korn. She studied in Greece and wrote her thesis on olive oil.
It is something that is taken for granted to a certain point because it's just everywhere.
But in the U.S., olive oil is still a niche product, says Daniel Sumner, an agricultural economist at UC Davis.
Olive oil is expensive relative to soybeans and palm oil and sunflower. That lowers its use.
Still, about 40% of households in the U.S. use olive oil. It's increasingly showing up in specialty processed foods like dressing and mayonnaise.
You get people that want to consume it for health. It's also gourmet food. People enjoy it in general.
About 95% of the olive oil sold in the U.S. is imported, according to the North American Olive Oil Association. Rising prices overseas could make domestic olive oil more competitive, says Joseph R. Profaci, the group's executive director.
99% of U.S. production is in California, but we're seeing investment and crops in Georgia and Texas, some in Florida and Arizona and Oregon.
He says olives, which are known for thriving in hot, dry climates, are still seen as a relatively sustainable crop, though planting trees in new regions as the world warms will take some time to bear fruit. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. I noted yesterday that Macy's is expecting to hire just about the same number of seasonal workers for the holidays this year as it did last year, about 40,000 or so, but way fewer than it hired 2 years ago. Okay, so there's that. But then this morning, Amazon announced it's looking for a 250,000 people, 250,000 people to staff up for the holidays. That's as compared to 150,000 last year. And warehouse and delivery workers are going to get a bump in pay. $20.50 an hour will be their wage. So retailers are betting we're going to shop, but way more online than brick and mortar. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context, just because we've talked about it quite a bit the past week or so. Instacart started trading today, had a nice little pop at the open, then came back to earth quite a bit. Still did finish better than 12% higher than where it started, $33.70 a share should you happen to be in the market. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.